Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we have new recording rigs and everything that we're testing out this week. You guys really have no idea what incredible machinations we go through to bring you the high fidelity, insightful podcast every week. But
we are wonks. We are not audio engineers.
It involves a lot of fighting with Skype and wine bottles, and it's a lot.
Yep.
So you're welcome.
You should thank us.
Speaking of which, what are we drinking?
We're drinking a Spanish white from Aaron's fridge.
That I put back in the fridge, and so now we can't see what it is.
Exactly. And also, we have a bottle of Layer Cake Shiraz, which I kind of want some cake now. And Radha, I believe, is drinking two things.
I am. Well, I'm drinking coffee because, you know, it's only 10 o'clock in the morning here. But I, in unpacking some boxes yesterday, discovered a Bombshell cocktail shaker. And
fabulous.
So made myself a grapefruit whiskey cocktail of some indeterminate nature, which is delicious and beautifully colored.
That looks fabulous.
And it's actually spring on the West Coast. So,
and it's like grapefruit, which means it's okay to drink in the morning. Mm-hmm. That's basically my rule.
That's what I say.
Yeah.
That's my theory as well.
Outstanding. Okay. So I don't think we have a great deal in the way of announcements. Some folks may have noticed that our Facebook page has had some book recommendations, and we have some specially tailored books by, about, and for women in honor of Women's History Month.
With a couple of authors who were friends of the pod and previous guests.
Yes,
Corey exactly. Shockey and Mark Harlan. I believe those are the only...
Caitlin Talmadge, who hasn't been on with us yet, but we hope
someday.
To have someday. And any number of those other ladies would be welcome to join us. There's some really good work, both fiction and nonfiction. So you guys should check all of those out. And I think we've got quite a lot to get through this week, which I know we say every week, but it's actually extra special true this time around. So let's get started. We have a special guest with us this week, Lindsay Ford. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi.
She joins us from the Asia Society Policy Institute, where she is the Director of Political Security Affairs and the Deputy Director of the Washington Office. So it's a lot on her plate and a lot in a title.
Indeed. Thanks, guys, for having me.
So Lindsay's had a number of jobs in the Defense Department, mostly focused in the Asia portfolio. And so we wanted to bring her in to help us understand exactly where we are with North Korea. So we've obviously covered North Korea from a couple different angles, really since the podcast started. So over the last year, we've had several guests talk about it. But I'm in particular interested in what is going on with these negotiations. So Lindsay, can you maybe help us start off by...
Wait. We have to do our guest questions.
Oh, shoot. Let's go through the Bombshell questions.
So I saw a tweet this morning that apparently one of our fans has actually included some of our questions in his daily life. So he has added entrance music to a conference that he is hosting for the lightning round speakers. So, you know, that's kind of fabulous.
That is one of my classmates from the great University of Kansas.
Excellent. I'm very proud.
Jack Martin, who's now the director of public affairs at the University of Washington. So,
wow.
Cool.
But they're going to have entrance music because we're awesome.
So speaking of entrance music, Lindsay, what is your entrance music?
Yeah, so I may have spent more time thinking about your intro questions than I did actually thinking about the substantive conversation that we're going to have. And I quizzed my husband on this one for something because his musical taste is so much cooler than mine. And then I just gave up and decided I would totally give in to the fact that I'm a complete music theater nerd. So my entrance music is going to be Don't Rain on My Parade with Barbara Streisand singing
yes,
some funny girl, because it's like the perfect odd girl theme song.
And it's very timely because of the military parade. Every time I think about the military parade, I have...
Wow.
You think of Barbara Streisand?
Yes, 100%.
Who does it? Really?
I hear Barbara Streisand in my head saying, don't rain on my... You know what I want to sing?
And now I'm thinking about sending the clowns, so it all fits together.
It does.
Wow. It took a dark turn.
Next question. What is your most quoted movie line?
Yep. Also went to my husband on this one because I don't actually quote movie lines. I quote song lines.
Thank you.
But I count. Sometimes
so
those songs
bad.
Are in movies.
So the only one that I came up with, actually I have to give a hat tip to Kelly Magsman on this one, because this sort of became a bit of a mantra in the Asia Pacific office at DOD. And it's from Dodgeball, which isn't even one of my favorite movies, but it relates to strategy. And the line is, it's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see how it works out for him. And you can use it so many times.
It's true. It is a real go-to, especially in this day and age.
It's certainly more useful than if you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball. So I'm going to pick a line for that movie.
Gold
See,
star
I have pop culture reference, guys.
Oh my God,
I know.
I'm so proud of you so many times today. What book does everyone else love but you can't stand?
So I confess that I've found very few books that I'm such a like geek when it comes to reading books. I read everything. My mom used to get mad at me because I would like stop and read signs on the walls. No, I know, embarrassing confession. So I came up with one that I don't think I hate, but that I have tried multiple times to read and I keep falling asleep every time, which is Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. I know I'm supposed to love it and I feel like compelled to read it, and I haven't made it past the first chapter.
It generates a lot of thinking very slowly in my mind as well.
Slow enough that I'm just comatose.
Well, you might try The Undoing Project, which is actually about the one is written by Michael Lewis, so it's a little pithier, and two is about Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky and about their relationship, and you get a lot of the tagline insights of behavioral economics without having to read all 1,000 pages of Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow.
What is your favorite bar in the world?
This one was easier. I have two, and one's like my home game and one's the away game. So the home game is the Broken Spoke in Austin, Texas, which is a
nice.
Which is a classic and has to be one of the only places where you will see like San Francisco like hipsters and 80-year-olds in Pearl Snaps shirts all like two-stepping together. So it's amazing.
Awesome.
And the away game is called Coup d'Etat. It's in Singapore. It's at the top of the Marina Bay Sands, which is this crazy looking hotel with like a boat on the top. And you're like 50 floors up overlooking the whole harbor, like with an infinity pool. It's insane. So those are my two choices.
Which one of you wants the last one?
Go ahead, Radha.
What is the best use of data or statistics you've ever seen?
Yes.
You're welcome.
I didn't have a great answer on this, so what came to mind was one that I just heard this past week listening to another podcast, which I confessed is our early morning on the way to school ride, which is Wow in the World, NPR's kids podcast. And yes, we learned about the fact that the Earth is actually slowing down by 1.8 milliseconds every 100 years. So your day is getting longer in spite of the fact that you think it's getting shorter.
That is a good statistic. I'm going to throw on an extra one because I'm always curious about this with Asia Hands. What is your favorite Asian breakfast buffet? Because you traveled to a lot of giant hotels in Southeast Asia.
It's so easy.
This is a great one.
Okay, go ahead.
It's the Shangri-La in Singapore.
Yeah.
Like, and there
how many stations do they have?
It's crazy. It's like nothing you've ever seen. I don't even know. It's an entire giant room just full of food. And Asian breakfasts are awesome because you're jet lagged, so you're not really sure what meal you actually want to eat, and you don't have to choose. So you can just eat like breakfast, dinner. I get like sushi next to bacon, mm-hmm. and then I'll like throw in some matar paneer, and it's excellent.
Fabulous. Okay, well, speaking of Asia, we're not going to do Southeast Asia. We're going to do Northeast Asia. Longtime listeners of the podcast will know we've talked about North Korea quite a lot. It's the gift that keeps on giving. But obviously, we've had some new developments here in the last few weeks. And I'll be honest, I'm having trouble really kind of figuring out what is actually going on. So if we could shift gears, Lindsay, and have you tell us a little bit of where do things stand as best we can tell right now with this new possibility of negotiations with North Korea?
Yeah, it's been a whirlwind the last few weeks. I'm not sure that anybody can tell you definitively what exactly is going on. So it appears that we are leading up to a summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-il. So this will be the first time.
Kim Jong-un.
Sorry. I'm like way back in time. Kim Jong-un, thank you. So it appears that we're leading up to a summit. So this would be the first time ever that you would have had this kind of summit with a sitting U.S. president. So it's pretty significant. I think caught a lot of people by surprise, possibly even the North Koreans and the South Koreans themselves, that we were going to go straight to that agreement. However, there's a whole lot of work that has to happen like in the lead up to that. And so what you're going to start to see over the next weeks and months is sort of all the working level discussions happening about what exactly will the terms of these negotiations look like. And, you know, all basically the for folks who love process, all of the staff work that goes into having something that's actually worth a presidential discussion.
Okay, but real talk, who do we have in those roles to do those jobs?
Yeah, so it's kind of fascinating because you know who's meeting with the South Korean foreign minister this week.
Yeah, I do.
Right.
And she doesn't have a security clearance or a background in East Asian deterrence or negotiations.
She has a fashion line. It's fine.
Yeah, right. For our listeners who don't know, that would be Ivanka Trump. Yes.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, that's one of the real questions, I think, in the next several weeks. Look, there are plenty of there's an interagency process going that the White House is running. There are plenty of civil servants, at least enough of them remaining, who have worked on these issues and can handle sort of the working level discussions. But I think you would, you know, be kidding yourself to pretend that the bureaucratic churn that we're going through right now, so with the Secretary of State out, a new one coming in who, you know, has what looks like a much more hawkish direction on North Korea, and then all sort of the constant chatter about the National Security Advisor going out, that this isn't going to impact being able to put a coherent sort of process and negotiation together.
And can I just ask, as part of the Iran deal, when we were doing this, we had two other big components, which were a bunch of allies who were at the table in discussions with us, and some technical leads in addition to diplomatic leads, right? So in that case, it was Secretary Moniz at the Department of Energy and his counterpart in Iran talking in great detail about very specific aspects of the nuclear program that needed to be shut down. So what are the analogs to that here? I can't imagine that Rick Perry is going to lead those.
Why not?
So I'm just guessing.
Yeah, there's not a good analog to that at this point. You know, in some ways, I think you could say maybe that's okay, because right now, like, we're really at the point where we probably just need to actually define terms, right? Are we actually talking about denuclearization? What do you mean when you say denuclearization? What do we mean? There's a whole lot of uncertainty about that. I mean, we don't even have an official statement from the North Koreans at this point about what they've actually
agreed
to.
That's one of the things that I wanted to try to unpack for sure.
Yeah, just one other analog to the Iran negotiation that I was going to ask about. So Wendy Sherman made this fabulous comment that they negotiated for the better part of a year just to set the terms of what the negotiation was going to be, and that to get the JPOA, and then they further negotiated to get the JCPOA. And to your point, Lindsay, there's nothing beyond the decision to actually get the presidents together to, you know, think about, like, what is our goal here? I think the administration was so caught off guard that they haven't really gotten their message consistent in terms of what's the overall intent. But if you had to make a prediction of where either you think they're going to end up or where you think they should be in terms of the parameters of this negotiation, what do you think it would be?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think in sort of an ideal world of what would you want coming out of this discussion, I would want some kind of, you know, statement from the presidents that is like a joint statement laying out the basic sort of terms of the discussion that we're going to have, what's included, what's not, some kind of agreement on a process forward. And then I think actually another key component here that's going to be important for the Trump administration doesn't actually have anything to do with the nuclear piece. And that's actually the three U.S. citizens who are still being held in North Korea. And so there's some there's been some stuff in the ROK media suggesting that discussions to actually get them released are fairly well underway. Mm-hmm. And I think for the president, it'll be important, especially when you look back on the Otto Warmbier issue and what happened there. And it would be a big diplomatic coup, honestly, for the president to go over and, you know, be able to get the citizens released. So
this morning there was news in the Wall Street Journal about U.S. North Korea meeting in Helsinki. That news was broken by the South Korean press. The White House at the time of this recording hasn't actually confirmed whether that's part of the talks. A whole
they have
separate
other things
thing
going on right now
for the U.S. But I guess my part of my question was, in terms of just process of setting those discussions, what things should we be looking for to build out towards that long-term defining terms of the agreement, discussion on these students, and discussion on the held U.S. citizens? And should we be watching for that in the South Korean press instead of the U.S. press? Like, what's kind of your feel on the process and next step?
Well, and my question related to that we alluded to a second ago is how far out over their skis are the South Koreans in general? Like,
yeah, I mean, I think one thing that sort of complicates these discussions in some ways, right, is the U.S. has not been in the driver's seat for the last, you know, for the last while, right? And I mean, how unprecedented is it to see the South Koreans doing a briefing on the White House lawn and there's no Americans? And so you've heard basically everything via the South Koreans at this point. And look, Moon came in very clearly wanting to take a much more diplomatic tack than the previous administration. And so, yes, there are allies, and yes, we're working hard to keep everybody in line. But I think they're going to be, let's just say, eager to frame and spin the North Korean discussion in the most positive light possible, probably more than we might put a positive spin on the same words.
And so how does that, you know, this is not the first time we've negotiated with the North Koreans.
Not even close.
And I will admit that I was certainly the farthest thing from East Asia or nuclear hand at the time that either the Bush administration or the Clinton administration were engaged in these discussions. If you take sort of juxtapose that South Korean optimism, I mean, it's almost a fake it till you make it sort of thing, right? With a lot of suspicion or kind of antibodies or residual reluctance on the American side across parties, across folks who've been engaged in this, you know, I don't want to say how dangerous is it to be negotiating with the North Koreans, but what are the risks to a really go-getting South Korean partner who we're definitely trying to keep on side with the alliance in general? And if you want to know what decoupling looks like, this is what it looks like. But also, you know, some real reluctance and some real burned bridges on between the U.S. and North Korea more generally. Where does that leave us in sort of a trust but verify world?
Yeah, verify, and we can talk about this, but verify is one of the main issues in sort of the North Korea negotiations where things tend to go south. I think one of the big things is going to be you've got a summit, a South-North summit coming, right? Like right before an American one. And there's going to be a lot of pressure, I think, on Moon to actually have something to deliver there, right? Because he's come out in a very forward-leaning way saying, yes, the North Koreans agreed to discuss denuclearization. And I think he's got to come out of that summit with some kind of confirmation that indeed that is the case.
Because we don't really have that yet.
No. We don't have it at all. And also, you don't have any certainty that even if they said it, that they really mean what we're talking about or what the Trump administration continues to insist on, which is the, you know, CVID, right? Complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization. And I think most experts would tell you that's not happening. And so the question is then, if they actually get something on denuclearization, what are we really talking about? If Moon doesn't have that, I think, you know, you may see the U.S. summit potentially not happen.
So typically when we've engaged with the North Koreans before, there have been lots of other folks at the table, whether it be Japanese, China, Russia. When they heard this announcement, what was their reaction, do you think, either publicly or behind closed doors?
I think there was sort of shock and surprise on all sides. But, I mean, hey, we're over a year into this administration, and that seems to be sort of like our MO is shock and awe on riding the roller coaster on everything. So Abe will be coming to the United States next month. Mm. And so you've got to believe that, you know, the main goal of that meeting is like, let's make sure, let's sort of like get lined up with Trump and make sure he's not about to do anything or give anything away that would really be problematic for us. Because for the Japanese, like, deep concerns, you have a kind of erratic U.S. president and you have South Koreans who really kind of just are focused on let's figure out how to make a diplomatic deal.
Right. And certainly one of the things that could be on the table from that perspective is something with regard to troop presence and the alliance more generally. So
right. I mean, when you see stuff coming out in the news about the president sort of musing about like maybe we will just pull our troops out if the trade deal goes south, right? It heightens anxieties.
So there's obviously lots more we could talk about. We're going to have to end it there for this particular discussion. But Lindsay, thanks for joining us. This has been great.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Shall we move on to keeping up foreign relations?
Or continue to keep up foreign relations or not keep up foreign relations, as the case may be.
Very much so.
So I think kicking us off on yet another different nuclear, denuclear, future nuclear power discussion, Iran is back in the news. So with Tillerson out and sort of churn at state and the president sort of longstanding discussion that he does not like the Iran deal and thinks it's the worst deal ever, except for all the trade deals, which are also the worst deals ever, he's going to pull out of them. And so we had this weekend the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker, who's also a Republican, stating that he anticipated the president pulling out of the Iran deal by May.
Really? By May?
Well,
that's the next 90-day cycle, yeah?
Correct.
Ish.
So basically, for our listeners, we recertify the Iran deal compliance and a range of other things. The president has already in the past said that he does not think the deal is in the U.S. national security interest, which I think allows the U.S. an out on this. This is the sort of international exit clause for different powers. It's not totally clear what the U.S. leaving the deal means. Not clear because the sanctions that were effective at bringing Iran to the table were obviously international sanctions, and the key two other players, Russia and European powers, are not terribly inclined to renege on the deal, especially with all evidence right now that Iran is continuing to comply. That having been said, Saudi Arabia has been like, if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, we want one too. So it's a lot of moving pieces, and I think withdrawal from the deal should be exciting.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a huge implications for our European allies. I feel like if we sort of unilaterally step out and they still desire to both contain Iran and limit their nuclear program, but also, I mean, putting that sanctions regime together was non-trivial to begin with. So that's a challenging dynamic on that front for sure. And of course, plays back into this North Korea discussion we were just having.
But then also in moving forward and thinking about if the Europeans wanted to continue the deal in some form or fashion, or they needed to, you know, converse amongst themselves, thinking about how the UK-EU dynamic, or UK versus France and Germany and others, I hadn't even thought about this until this morning and looking at the issue we're about to discuss next, the Russians who were poisoned in the UK, how the UK is really weakened in terms of their ability to work with the EU to think about future sanctions or future foreign policy initiatives with any part of Europe.
So let's talk about that. So what happened in the UK this week or last week?
I just got back from a trip to London, and I confess anytime I went into a pub, I just sort of looked around thinking, is anyone going to poison me with something that I'm not aware of right now? Do I just pound my beer and leave? How do I handle
this? That's a good strategy.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. It's not typically how one acts in a pub. But the short story is that a former Russian spy, or as the Russian government termed it, a British spy who was working in Russia, and his daughter were in a pub in Salisbury and exited quite quickly, sat on a bench, and were found completely passed out and apparently poisoned with a nerve agent that is made in Russia and are in critical condition in a UK hospital. And the nerve agent itself apparently impacted, I think, a couple of dozen other British citizens who are around, not nearly to the extent. And the Russians have basically responded by being kind of pains in the asses about it, by being like not admitting faults, not saying that we did anything that had anything to do with this, but basically being obnoxiously almost at fault in all of their kind of crazy tweets that they've been doing the past couple of days.
Also not explicitly denying it, right?
No.
They're like, we have no motive. Well, actually, you did. And also, that doesn't mean you didn't do it. And the second piece of that is just the nerve agent itself apparently is one that is much more traceable to Russia than other types of things one might use, I guess, if you were so inclined. So it's hard to understand whether this is like not that hard. It seems like it could be a signal to being like, hey, we do what we want. Don't cross Russia.
Well, and of course, there's that BuzzFeed story that came out a few months ago that documented some 13 or 17 some suspicious deaths of Russian persons in the UK over the last, I don't know, 5+ years. There was, of course, the famous polonium case a while back that was pretty clearly traced to Russia, but was less clearly traced to Russia than this one was.
But also, wasn't it in the last week that another Russian I'm about to say refugee. Another Russian was found in Europe having been strangled to death.
Yes.
And within the same time period, obviously not something that's as easily traceable to Russia. But I mean, the question in my mind has been, is this a massive FU from Putin to the Brits and others saying like, yeah, you can clearly catch me, or you clearly know that it's me and I don't care because you're not going to punish me? Or is it some sort of like basically very flawed operation that came out of the lower levels of the, not KGB, the FSB, saying, who weren't quite thinking through how traceable this operation was going to be?
I think those are great questions. I mean, there's a large Russian diaspora in London. There's a huge amount of Russian money in London. The London stock bubble, real estate bubble, is largely Russian influenced, among others. But I think it's easy for Americans to miss just what the influence is of, you know, large amounts of Russian cash of varying kinds in London finance and real estate and other circles. And so this is in some ways like a very intra-Russian dispute. I mean, this is somebody is clearly eliminating enemies of the Putin regime for a variety of offenses.
But there was a lot of, as we might say in the United States, collateral damage.
That's right.
In this case. So I think people are looking to Theresa May in terms of what is her actual response going to be. And I mean,
she's expelled the 23 diplomats.
She's about 23 diplomats, with the Russians responded in kind, expelling 23 diplomats, as well as saying that the Brits couldn't open up a cultural center and a couple other smaller things in Russia. And in her speech that she made, addressed a couple other things that the Brits may consider like not sending high-level officials to the World Cup, looking at Russian real estate deals in London, and a few other things that in my mind were largely symbolic and not actually punitive against the Russians, but it kind of remains to be seen. And then we get to the U.S. response, which I think has been fairly interesting.
Well, it was delayed, right? And then it was thin. Eventually, there was a NATO response. Kay Bailey Hutchison made some comments there. But certainly, it was no, you know, usually you talk about people not wanting to see any daylight between the Brits and the Americans. And there were large sunbeams of daylight between their response and ours.
Eventually, the president did come out and say that he had talked to the prime minister, that it seemed all indications were that the Russians were behind this. And then there was a joint, I believe, statement amongst the US, UK, France, and others that, again, was actually fairly late in this whole process. But this all kind of comes on the heels of, well, I guess not comes on the heels, comes ahead of some U.S. actions to sanction Russia related to the 2016 elections. So it wasn't quite linked, but it was an interestingly timed release on the United States part. Maybe indicating that we're going to take a harder line on Russian actions right now. Kind of doubt it, since there wasn't really a whole lot that was super new in these new rounds of sanctions. Did you guys have another different perspective on that?
I found the timing to be coincidental, yeah, more than anything else. So,
yeah,
you know, I guess we'll see.
And I think this administration, you know, waiting to see and make sure that there was sufficient evidence that Russia was linked would feel like, okay, maybe that's just a signal of caution from a new administration. In this case, with this administration, it's sort of hard to make the case that they feel strongly about waiting for all the evidence being in before having the president make statements / tweets. And so in that world, it makes it particularly notable that how much time elapsed between Theresa May talking and an official White House response from the president.
So speaking of the White House, there's been even more mayhem than usual. Before we reflect too deeply on that, I guess we do want to note that this was actually a quite deadly week for American service personnel. There were 7 Air Force personnel killed in Iraq in a helicopter crash, and 2 naval officers killed off Key West in an F-18 crash. And that's, I don't know, for me, always just serves as a reminder of, you know, there's a lot of, I don't know, parlor tricks and dynamics here in Washington, but there are very real people who pay very real costs to these decisions, both over time and, you know, in some really concrete ways. So,
and both of those were training and transport missions. These are not combat
missions.
And so, yeah, a reminder that there's a lot of risk that these personnel are taking, even in sort of maintaining our readiness for these types of things.
That's right.
So in the world of mayhem, in one of his final acts that I guess at the time we maybe should have known was his final act because of how divergent it was from the White House, Rex Tillerson made a statement basically completely supporting Theresa May, saying that this was clear that the Russians were behind the attack on the two Russians in Salisbury. And he was on a trip to Africa at the time that he had to cut short in some ways because he was ill, but then apparently received a phone call from John Kelly while indisposed in some way, indicating that he may or may not be receiving a tweet that would piss him off and he should probably come home. And then the story moves in all kinds of fascinating ways.
I just, there's like, you know, how is that conversation not the president has decided that your tour is over, please return home? How's that conversation? There might be a tweet. I mean that part to me is the, like, even crazier than him taking the call in the toilet is really the most bizarre part of that story.
I mean, the only thing that I could think of that even slightly justifies how that story came out was that maybe John Kelly called him saying, like, look, I'm trying really hard to manage this situation. Got this tweet ready to go. I've been trying to prevent it, just so you know. But that's not how John Kelly appears to be telling it right now. So it's clearly aware of, you know, Rex Tillerson was subsequently fired via tweet, in which the president announced that Mike Pompeo would be taking his place and Gina Haspel would be taking Mike Pompeo's place at the CIA.
And the guy who told us about that firing via tweet and Tillerson's surprise was then subsequently fired, right?
Yes.
Just checking.
Yes, the Undersecretary of State for Public Affairs was also
said he was no longer needed.
That's right. Why would we want one of those?
So if Mike Pompeo goes to state, what does that mean?
Mike Pompeo from the great state of Kansas, like 2 years ago, was a congressional representative from the 4th district. So what's interesting, we didn't get a chance to talk to Lindsay about this, but CIA has played a pretty important role in back-channeling with North Korea the last few months. And so it seems that this will be firmly in his lane once he goes to state. There's a confirmation hearing, of course, that has to take place and needs to be confirmed by the Senate. But he is definitely, I think, less excited overall about negotiations than Rex Tillerson. Tillerson had definitely been leading the push for more meaningful negotiations. I think Pompeo is largely regarded as a hawk, both with regard to North Korea and with regard to Iran. And so it's really hard to see, you know, to the extent that Secretary Mattis has been defending the Iran deal, which he wasn't always in love with, but I think thinks is better than most of the alternatives at this point. It's not clear what allies he has on that front at this point in the process. So both on North Korea and Iran, Pompeo is going to have his hands full. And then there's, of course, a question of how he actually, like, interacts with the rest of the building at Foggy Bottom, which a lot of people are interested in.
I mean, it seems like, for better or worse, he wasn't a terrible manager at CIA. Certainly not in the way that Tillerson was at state. He seemed to use a building at least somewhat, and he seemed to have folks' backs when he talked publicly and sort of wasn't quite as negative about the institution and the career people serving in that institution. So on a management side, and frankly as a stopgap from the massive sort of loss of personnel and expertise at state, this might not be the end of the world.
Well, that's high praise.
This might not be the end of the world, which we can't say that about some other possible personnel replacements that may be coming up. So
that's right.
I guess it could be worse in a lot of ways.
So related, maybe not the end of the world track, but there's actually been most of the controversy the last week or so has been with regard to Pompeo's replacement at CIA, which is Gina Haspel. And what do we know about her?
So we don't actually know a lot, as we don't actually know a lot about a lot of CIA career employees. But there have been a number of stories over the past few years, in particular one by ProPublica in 2017, indicating that Gina Haspel oversaw one of the black sites that CIA used for its renditions and subsequent torture sites. This one, in this case, was in Thailand, I believe, and that she was the chief of base But this is actually the issue that we have with a lot of U.S. policy with regard to torture is what we know is fairly limited. We don't have a full picture. We didn't have a full accounting of what went on within the CIA and who was truly responsible during the Bush or Obama administrations. So a lot of the blame that could go around is still somewhat mysterious and in some ways probably misplaced or maybe overemphasized on some people and not enough on others.
So, or unevenly placed.
Right.
Right. So there's certainly a lot of folks who think that it is completely unacceptable for her to become the director of the CIA. Although from folks that I know at the agency, they think that she would actually be a pretty steady hand. Like they think that they are in favor of that. Now take that for what it's worth. But it is definitely part of, I think, as you say, Lauren, you know, we didn't go through a process where people were held accountable for their actions. Some of those people had high-ranking office in the Obama administration as well, both at the agency and elsewhere. And so now we're left 10 years later with what do you do with career employees who were engaged in a lot of really awful activity, but that was sanctioned by the U.S. government.
I should say one other key component there that I think is it's not even a matter of like her relation to these programs, but also the fact that she apparently destroyed evidence related to it. I think some people feel more strongly about that piece than they do about her relation to the actual program itself, because it speaks to a level of trust and accountability that I think that you have to have in your CIA leadership.
Right.
And so I was going to just make two quick points, which were one, it has been almost entirely lost, but she would be the first female director of the CIA, I believe, which is just notable and something to think about. And two, as Aaron said, there are a number of people in the Obama administration who went through and short of saying we're going to have a public reckoning of accountability to anyone who is in any way involved in or aware of these types of rendition activities, it seems like we've got a real disproportionate penalty being paid to this particular person in this particular role at this particular time. And I think it's just sort of notable those two facts together, it seemed.
I mean, what's interesting is that John Brennan might have had to go through this had he been nominated to be director of the CIA at the beginning of the Obama administration. He was not. He ultimately was nominated to be director of the CIA in 2013. And his sort of come to Jesus moment with Congress was about the drone program. So there was a lot of drama in that instance, but it was more focused on what are the specifics of the drone program, not about what his role of the CIA during the torture years.
And I've heard people express concern in a complicated sort of way. I can't decide exactly how I feel about this set of explanations, but that those personnel serving under a president who had removed torture as a matter of policy, who was working toward a different drone disposition, is very different than somebody who had actively and perhaps very willingly participated in torture and rendition serving under this administration. And, you know, that's a pretty partisan argument, and I think requires a little bit of willful naivete. But it's not entirely wrong either. And so I've been sort of playing through that thought process in my head in terms of what is the nature, you know, that we talked about character and clearances and at the last podcast, I think. And, you know, what is the temperament you want for a CIA director in a Trump administration? And I think that's a pretty challenging question for a lot of folks. She will, of course, also go through a confirmation hearing, which will make this a pretty busy legislative calendar. Just to wrap up the mayhem, I mean, this is not the only set of personnel changes. We have a new council or economic advisor, chief economic advisor. Gary Cohn lost the tariffs war and left. Looks like Larry Kudlow is going to replace him. And we're all waiting to see what happens with the national security advisor. So, I mean, that's a story that's been, you know, in the mix for quite a while, but one of the narratives that's going around kind of right now, and I wonder what you guys think about this, is that, you know, President Trump, now fully a year into his administration, is sort of casting off all of these establishment people who he was told he needed to hire and who he feels has been boxing him in. And now he's really hitting his stride and he's going to do things his way with his people. And so Tillerson's going to go, maybe McMaster goes, Cohn goes, and he's going to do things his way. And what does that even mean?
To see, like, okay, so who does he think of as his people?
Because I agree.
One of the people that's being batted around, as people know, as a replacement for McMaster, is John Bolton, who is the neocon of neocons. Like, the man has not seen a war he doesn't want to do more with in his lifetime. So if John Bolton comes in as national security advisor, like, that's a huge break from where Trump was in his campaign and kind of sort of where he's been as president, but he does have a very similar attitude as President Trump and sort of the, like, you know, screw everything, I'll just blow it up kind of lifestyle, which maybe will make for a coherent foreign policy if dangerous.
I will say, I mean, look, in as much as Trump won the Electoral College, and let's leave all the election debate, he is the president and he ran on a bunch of really different things. And he should probably, I feel more concerned when he has people like Gary Cohen, who are the globalist, air quotes, maintaining trade deals that are distinct from his presidency, than when he appoints advisors to advise him on policies that he has strong opinions about. So if we're going to have a protectionist, you know, unequal, you know, regressive tax system, economic policy, let's have an economic advisor who does that. And if we're going to have a let's blow this shit up president and he wants a blow this shit up national security advisor, then this is what democracy looks like. And so, you know, that's kind of where we are.
I think just for Radha's sake, I should mention that Larry Kudlow is not an economist. He may be an economic advisor.
Not.
He is not an economist.
He also has the distinct honor of having been wrong basically every time he talked about or predicted anything, including maintaining that a recession was not happening well into the Great Recession. So, you know, he's 0 for a lot, which is awesome.
That's going to be great. I mean, I think it's actually an important point. So we actually might get more coherence as we have cabinet officials who are actually aligned with the president and not creating clear obstacles toward his preferred policies. But it's, I mean, I don't actually don't know what, I mean, Kudlow is actually pro-free trade. So we're not actually improving the coherence on that question. And Bolton, I mean, I guess he could get into line on some part of the, like, nationalistic militarism, but like I agree that I'm not clear exactly how he would try to implement this, other than he's definitely not on board for a grand bargain with the North Koreans.
Decidedly,
it feels
no,
like.
Except to, like, maybe use the negotiation itself as a means to have an excuse to go blow up the North Koreans in any way.
Yeah, that well, that's a cheery thought.
Isn't
okay.
It?
Should we talk about pop culture? Do we have some pop culture to discuss?
God, yes.
There are, like, I feel like my movie list is very long at this point.
Yep.
I think Ready Player One is in theaters or is about to be in theaters with mm-hmm. some mixed reviews, but I think most of us read that book and are at least interested in what Steven Spielberg is going to do with that in a visual medium. I'm very excited because there's a new Wes Anderson movie coming out, which is Isle of Dogs, and it's another animated feature, which is like, if Wes Anderson wasn't already Wes Anderson enough, animated Wes Anderson is exactly what you need in your life. So
that sounds right.
That's where I'm at. What else? Occupied.
Occupied is back.
Did you guys all watch season one?
I did, but I have to confess, it's going to be a big struggle for me to want to get into a subtitled series again.
Yeah, I mean, I'm watching Babylon Berlin right now, which is a lot of fun. They do the Berlin accents really well, which is sort of like a Brooklyn accent in American English. But like, it, you can't text or tweet or do anything else while you're watching because you, I mean, my German is pretty rusty and I can get like the very basics, but you have to watch with the subtitles the whole time. So Babylon Berlin is excellent for folks who are kind of into interwar German intrigue, and also like cabaret. That's how I would place that for the group.
And who doesn't like both of those things at the same time?
They go so well together. Radha, do you have any pop culture?
Well, I will say that I just watched the Avengers Infinity War trailer.
Wow.
Which after, I know. So here's the thing. Last night we had a heated discussion on our favorite superhero movies, and extended discussion that we can have another time. But the upshot was that apparently this new trailer makes the movie look like it doesn't suck. And it is true. All of the early clips from it, we were like, wow, no one's going to watch this. But I'm just saying, watch the trailer, judge for yourself. It looks like it might actually be a pretty good time.
I mean, I'll be honest. I love all Marvel Comics movies. I'm not a comic book person. I've never read them before.
Me neither.
They're fabulous. In my pop culture universe, I watched The Darkest Hour on a plane, which, you know, plane movie. So I was clearly sobbing for three quarters of the entire movie.
Right. Yeah.
And like, you know, it didn't really strike me as entirely accurate. Somebody described it to me as a Churchill fan fiction, which is totally true.
It's totally true.
Yeah, that's the best way to describe it. If you love Churchill, then go see it because it's some hardcore Churchill fan fiction. And guys,
but I thought that they did a pretty good job. I also watched it on a plane. And I was surprised. I found the folks who were trying to persuade him to settle actually fairly compelling.
Yeah.
I mean, and they were taking
Lord
that argument.
Halifax was kind of like, you're kind of hot.
Also that. But that the sort of, I mean, there's a way to watch a movie that is pure fan fiction, but there's another way to watch that movie where this man was disgraced at Gallipoli. He's been wrong on every foreign policy issue for basically a lot of his career. He's an arch-imperialist, which they leave out, but is certainly part of the narrative. And all he knows in this one moment is that they have to fight. And there's a certain, I mean, the appeal of that from a narrative perspective is incredibly moving. But the actual weighing of the decision of it, wow. I mean, it's not clear that that is the like rational choice, you
not
know,
at
in
all.
That in that moment. I think they dramatized that really, really well.
But if you have not been to the Churchill War Rooms, which is where much of the movie takes place, and next time you're in London, get off the plane and go immediately there because it
did you go on your trip?
I went on my previous trip. It's just tremendous. One of the best museum experiences. We talked about it many times on Bombshell. But linking. Another pop culture experience. So director Krennic is King George in the movie. I don't know if you noticed that.
You're right. He is. From Rogue One.
Yep. Guys, I haven't seen The Last Jedi. And it's out on Amazon now. I know. And I'm going to go home and watch it tonight.
Hasn't
Rada
seen it and you haven't?
Yep.
Oh, man.
Yep.
I know. Wow. I'm going to
take a moment, Rada,
for a minute. Yeah.
Well, now you have no excuse. You can watch it, you know, do what Nicole Cliff does and hire a babysitter so that you can watch movies
all day in your bedroom. I love that.
All right, ladies, anything else?
I think that's it for me.
It's been great. We'll see everybody in a couple weeks. Thanks.